Yesterday, the title of the session was Doing More and Enjoying It Less, and today is kind of the second part of that, which I've titled Finding Spirituality in the Active Life. And just to kind of recap a little bit from yesterday, we talked about why it is we think we're doing more now, why it seems like we're so busy. And I just sort of summarized some of the things that we talked about. One of the reasons given was that we have more, so we have more to take care of. Advanced technology has increased both the complexity and the speed at which we can do tasks, and so now we're expected to do them that much faster. And so that seems to have compounded the amount of work that we do. There's a greater emphasis on results and productivity. That's what the world seems to reward is, you know, if we can quantify it, we value it. If it's something like caring for each other or raising our children or taking care of people that need some extra help, we can't really quantify that. And so that isn't something that seems to get rewarded that much in the outside world. Also, the role of media, the fact that it influences how we think we should be living, encourages us to actively engage in this production-consumption model, which seems to lend to our busyness. And then we talked about why we're enjoying doing all of this less, and some of the reasons that were given. And many of these come from Parker Palmer's book, The Active Life, were the fact that we're not leading active lives, we're leading reactive lives. And that some of the things we react to the expectations of others. We react to the fear of failure. That's sometimes a reason why we do things. We are struggling for our own identity. And we tend to define ourselves in this Western culture by what we do. And so if we're good at something like the poem yesterday, The Active Life, the brave woman looks for an opportunity to show bravery. The strong man looks for an opportunity to show his strength, that sometimes we sort of live by self-fulfilling prophecies, both in positive and negative ways. I mean, we may look for a chance to exhibit our abilities, to sort of affirm who we are. And also we might get into some awfulizing, you know, and if we worry and fret about what might happen, it just may come to pass because we've geared ourselves in that direction. And the last one that we left off with yesterday was this idea that we have a need to be the makers of things. You know, we're going to make products, make friends, make love, make war, make peace. You know, somehow we're in control. And there's a sense to which we like that, or we think we like that. And as the Chuang Tzu said, what a pity. What a pity if this is what the active life is about. And Parker Palmer says, well, he says, you know, in the beginning ages, contemplation was really rewarded. If you think about the time of the Greeks and the Romans, that those who held the highest station in life, they were allowed to be contemplative. They were not the worker bees. We put a high value on this. This was thought to be the more spiritual way to live. But then with the industrial age and the realization that knowledge of how to make things and have utility created a certain kind of power. And the pendulum has sort of swung the other direction. So we concentrate more on being a society of action. And what I offered for consideration yesterday, and we'll talk about more today, is thought that these are really not polar opposites, that it's really a paradox, and that somehow finding a spiritual life is living in a meaningful tension between the two and sort of at the same time adhering to the calling of our own pole. So Some of us by nature may be more contemplative. Some of us by nature may want to engage more in the active life. And he has a quote, or I should say a statement, about his own view on life. He says, "I value spontaneity more than predictability, exuberance more than order, inner freedom more than the authority of tradition, the challenge of dialogue more than the guidance of a rule, eccentricity more than staying on dead center." Now, how does that statement compare with the way we described busyness or activity yesterday? See any comparison? Wow, this sounds like pretty good stuff to me. I mean, you know, spontaneity, exuberance, the challenge of dialogue, eccentricity. I mean, those things all appeal to me quite a bit. Being busy, having to do more, fulfilling other people's expectations, being afraid of failure, all that kind of stuff, that's not very much of a turn on, at least for me. So somehow he's saying, you know, this action doesn't have to be frenzy, and that maybe there's a way that we can engage in this active life and still find some balance and spirituality. I'd like to start out with a poem about the woodcarver. It's also from the book The Way of Chuang Tzu, the poem that I read yesterday. And this is what he has to say. "King, the master carver, made a bell stand of precious wood. When it was finished, all who saw it were astounded. They said it must be the work of spirits. The Prince of Lu said to the master carver, 'What is your secret?' King replied, 'I am only a workman. I have no secret. There is only this. When I began to think about the work you commanded, I guarded my spirit and did not expend it on trifles that were not to the point. I fasted in order to set my heart at rest. After 3 days of fasting, I had forgotten gain and success. After 5 days, I had forgotten praise or criticism. After 7 days, I had forgotten my body with all its limbs. By this time, all thought of your highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand. Then I went to the forest to see the trees in their own natural state. When the right tree appeared before my eyes, the bell stand also appeared in it, clearly, beyond doubt. All I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin. If I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all. What happened? My own collective thought encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits." Okay, what do you think of that? Any just first impressions of the kind of activity that this woodcarver was engaged in? Why did he do what he did?
Because he liked to.
Okay, because he liked to. Was that the only reason that he carved the bell stand? You say he was inspired, or it was inspiring? He was inspired. Any other reasons? Well, didn't the Prince of Lu command it?
Yeah.
Okay, so he really didn't have a choice as far as what he was going to do. He was commanded to carve a bell stand. What do you think would have happened if he decided that he couldn't find the right tree, or he wasn't inspired to do it? Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate guess of what would have happened. So, you know, going back to this need to be makers, you know, we can't get away from the fact in our society that we're going to have demands put on us to work. I mean, that's one of the ways that Palmer defines work. It's something we do because of an outside demand, a demand put on us to which we respond. So the reason he did it was because he basically had to do it. He was commanded to do it. But what changed the quality of the action? I mean, did the experience sound like the ones we were describing yesterday?
First he accepted his task, and then he got focused on doing it without any distractions.
Yeah, the first thing he did is he sort of cleansed himself of all outward distractions and inward ones as well. I mean, he says that, you know, by the fifth day or whatever, he'd even forgotten his own body and the needs of himself. So he'd become really centered. What else did he forget?
Trying to please anybody else about how he did it.
Yeah, I think that's really key, is that even though the Prince Alu was there with the power to, if he didn't come up with a bell stand or one that was acceptable in order to approach this task, he even forgot about that. Why is that important? I mean, we like the way he describes how he accomplished this bell stand.
Well, in a sense, he's not pleasing the king anymore, but he's doing what gives him great pleasure, because he's done the preparation, and then it's his own genuine creative spirit that's doing it.
Yeah, and she said creative spirit. And that's something that I think when we think of creativity as opposed to work being something that we do as a response to an outside demand, something creative comes always has to be out of some sense of freedom. You know, creativity, there may be creativity in your work as there was in this. The work was in response to the outside command. But the way in which he did it, he found his own inner centeredness and freedom in which to accomplish the task. So I think one of the points that Palmer discusses as far as this story is concerned is that just because the call comes from outside us doesn't mean that the action is a wrong action or has to be a frenzied action. That just because we're doing something in response to the demands of the world doesn't mean that we have to do it without a sense of freedom. That we still have, you know, this ability to, he calls it a right action. I have a little problem with right and wrong terminology. Another term that he uses to describe it is a faithful action. One that's faithful to yourself and to the true nature of things. He defines it as a form of action that is at once more disciplined and more liberating than the frenzy that we in the West often equate with the act of life. And he talks about four elements of action that I thought we could discuss today to kind of explore the nature of our activities and how they might be more satisfying in a spiritual way. First, he talks about our motives. Second element of skills and gifts. The third is the other. And the fourth, results. Being something, these are elements that he believes are wrapped up every time we do some kind of an action. So let's look first at motives. He suggests that every time we do something that's important to us, or if we're not happy with the way that we're doing something, we say, why am I doing this? Now, if we go back to yesterday and we talk about some of the different kinds of things that we get engaged in, we find out that we're not really doing it out of some sense of inner freedom or inner truth to who we are, but we're doing it because somebody else expects us of it. So, you know, somebody else is demanding it because we're afraid of failing, because the media says that we should have this thing, and so we go out and work and find a way to get it. So, you know, this is kind of a first step in the analysis. When we go back again, why was the wood carver doing what he was doing? Well, because he was commanded to do it. But again, just because the call comes from the wrong place or from the wrong reason doesn't mean that it was a wrong call. I mean, has anybody here ever had an experience in life where they made a job change or made a change in their personal life that initially seemed like a miserable choice, but as you look back on it, you can see how it fit into the pattern of moving to something that was better or more in keeping with what you see as your true path in life. Anybody want to share anything? Well, I'll be happy to share one of my experiences. I moved from a fairly good-sized city and a good-sized law practice to join a very small firm, and this was for family reasons. I thought I'd move to a different geographic area, provide a better life for my daughter, and it turns out that this firm was just, I mean, it was the worst place I've ever worked in my life. You know, being a car hop at the drive-in restaurants was better than this job. You know, these folks were kind of greedy, and you know, I just had some real problem with the way the business was conducted, and I thought, how do I end up here? You know, I mean, this is certainly a wrong call and a wrong move on my part, but somehow I had felt a strong sense at the time that these decisions came together that that's what I was supposed to do. Well, as it turned out, it was the first stepping stone to doing the things that I'm doing now, which I'm very excited about, teaching and doing community service work that I never would have had the opportunity to do if I hadn't taken that first step. And if that first step had been a positive one, I wouldn't be where I am now. So, you know, wrong calls sometimes end up in actions that we find a lot more satisfaction in. Move on to the second one, skills and gifts. What do you think? Does everybody have a gift or a skill? Or are there some of us that are born? You're shaking your head, yes. What?
Well, I'm sure we all have gifts, many gifts, that we won't even recognize ourselves.
Okay, why do you think it is that we won't recognize some of those? So I think that's important.
Sometimes we're just afraid that we'll be called on to use them, maybe.
And we were afraid because
that we won't be perfect, that we won't do it like somebody else expects that we could do it or something.
Yeah, we have kind of a confidence problem about some of our own natural abilities, and so unless it's something that we have a degree in, or we've trained lots of years, or we've had lots of years of work experience in, we feel like, you know, what business is it of mine now to do this when there are people that have trained for this particular thing? Or the flip side of that, I think, is what if you spend years and years working at a particular job or studying to be something, and then after you've done that, you find out that your true calling is someplace else? I mean, life doesn't always give us we don't feel that it gives us that luxury then to follow the true calling. And, you know, again, it sort of ties back into that circle. Why is it that we don't end up following our path of our true gift? Well, it might be the expectations of others. I certainly deal with enough law students that are there not because they want to be there, because, you know, their mother or their father or their grandparents always wanted to be a lawyer. And it's amazing the number of them that leave law school and never practice law or do anything really directly related with their law degree because, you know, they've now fulfilled the expectation they went to law school, and then some of them follow the road of true calling. You know, the other thing is that I think that we sometimes lack patience. You know, there's this pressure for people to make a decision. You know, what do we start asking kids as soon as they can have a conversation with us?
When you grow up.
Yeah, what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, although it's ironic, I think back now, just at the moment that you were saying that, I thought about in kindergarten when I was asked and I said I wanted to be a teacher. And then I thought I never, you know, that I took a different path. And, well, that's where I ended up. So maybe that was the path of early on. Maybe I had identified it. But I think that we do pressure people, and we look for sort of drive-through insight in our lives. You know, we want everything fast. It's like we want to sit down, we want to force it, we want to solve the problem, we want to come up with the answer. We don't like to have things that are out there and sort of unsettled. Okay, I think the one that's most striking in the story of the woodcarver is the other. Who's the other in this story?
Prince.
Okay. And why the prince?
He's the one who sort of forced this guy to do his endeavor. Not his own thing entirely, I guess.
Okay.
At least doesn't start off that way.
So the other can be the outward compelling force that places a demand on us. Is there another other in this?
Well, when I was thinking about it, I thought the tree.
Yeah.
Because.
And that's, I think that's the answer that is most often given, but I'm glad you said the prince, because I think that's what makes it so complex, is that really in action we're not dealing with just the other that's sort of co-participating with us in whatever the task is at hand, but we've got the others that are the external force as well. And so, in this case, the woodcarver had to really separate himself from the external other and the fear of that, and try to do what with the tree?
Almost become one with it, because he had to see just the very essence of it. He could then see what he could do with it or what it could become.
Yeah, you know, in order for him to be true to the action, he not only had to find his own inner truth, and he did that by fasting and sort of, you know, freeing himself from all these external, you know, needs of the body and whatever, and the prince, but then he had to get in touch and discern the true nature of the tree and connect with that. And then how did he go about carving this bell stand? I mean, did he come into the forest with a pack of blueprints and said, okay, I've got my design and now I've got to find the tree that's going to make this easiest and most economical and keep my profit margin as high as possible?
Well, it made it sound like he saw it there before he even touched the tree. I mean, he just knew what it could become.
Yeah, he waited for the tree to basically speak to him and say, you know, that's right, and I'm going to make a good bell stand. So he didn't have the design. Now, you know, let's think about it. If you were the woodcarver and you had Prince Lou, who was known to be a pretty moody guy and kind of particular about his particular but not predictable in what he liked, and you were a master woodcarver, what would the temptation be in fulfilling this job?
To do something to please somebody else.
Yeah, and you know, think about it in your own jobs. I mean, if you found something that works, even if it's not a masterpiece, but it works, isn't there a temptation to go that route? You find out what somebody's particular likes or dislikes are, or as your own mastery, you say, well, I'm good at this, and I know I can do this, so even though maybe that would be better or would yield better results, I'm going to do this because it's safer. There's a tendency we don't want to take risks because we're afraid, as you said before. I mean, even if we have this gift, maybe other people won't like it. Maybe it'll be a failing. Maybe it won't turn out. So he really took a huge risk when you think about it. I mean, rather than going with something that he knew would work, he went to the tree and let the tree kind of direct what it was he was going to do. Anybody here try their hand down at the pottery shop since they've been here? Or anybody here a potter? Okay. I had the good fortune on the way up here to be on the ferry with a man named Jack Everett, who was also coming to Holden for just a couple days. 2 years ago, I think he taught pottery here, and now he's a pastoral counselor and uses his art as a metaphor for healing, and he was describing to me, you know, using the potter's wheel, and I said, well, you know, that's something I'd like to try. That really sounds interesting to me. So I went down to the pot shop and watched him throwing, is what they call it, throwing mugs and vases and all this kind of thing. And it was just, he made it look effortless. You know, it was just, he sat down there, put the lava clay on, and it just would seem like it would form as if by magic between his hands. So I'm thinking, well, I sure can't come up with something that looks this nice, but you know, after a few lessons, I'll at least be able to come up with something that holds water. And so I sat down, and it was just incredible, the experience of realizing that this clay really does have a mind of its own. And you know, it's not going to be so easily molded. You know, to have to first work it and knead it and get it, you know, properly in shape, get it centered on the wheel, hold it with the proper pressure from all sides, and then with a steady hand, you know, to make the opening, to build the walls, you know, needless to say, I mean, I don't have anything physical to show for the experience of working on the potter's wheel. But what I learned was a lot more beneficial in that, again, it's the property of the other, the action. You know, it's not just my will, not just what I want to make. You know, right away I had that sort of make mentality. Well, I'm on a vacation, I'm going to make a souvenir kind of a thing. That's what we all do. We go down to the shop and try to, you know, have something we can show when we get back. But it was this, you know, intuiting the properties of the other and realizing that that not only opens up all sorts of possibilities once you understand what those properties are, but it also puts certain limitations. You know, I used to do stained glass work, and I went through the same kind of process with that, you know, realizing that you can't just put a pattern down on the glass of any old shape or design and zip around it with your glass cutter and pop it out, because glass doesn't work that way. It has its own physical properties. Anybody here have any experiences you want to...
Well, I do watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a fight to get it to do like you want it to do. And then when you were talking about this earlier, I thought about my husband and his criticism to begin with until I got confident enough to tell him, bug off, you know.
I like that. We can add that to the list, the bug off principle, you know, is one that we have to learn on the road to spirituality. There's a sense of doing something because it's in keeping with our inner truth and not because it's something that's going to be rewarded out in the world. I've been trying to work on a sketch, you know, the scene down by the mine. It's probably nothing I'll ever show anyone, but it's something that, you know, I feel the need to do, and hopefully I can do it without worrying whether or not anybody likes it. Another story in Palmer's book that I would like to share with you on the subject of really understanding the other. It has to do with a butcher. And this is somebody in China that has been a butcher, butchering oxen for some 19 years. And people are amazed because this knife that he uses is sharp and looks new. And he's been using the same one for 19 years. And they say, you know, how is it that you can be using the same blade after such a long period of time? And he responds, there are spaces in the joints. The blade is thin and keen. When this thinness finds that space, there is all the room you need. It goes like a breeze. Hence, I have this cleaver 19 years as if newly sharpened. True, there are sometimes tough joints. I feel them coming. I slow down. I watch closely, hold back, barely move the blade, and whoomp. The part falls away, landing like a clod of earth. Then I withdraw the blade. I stand still and let the joy of the work sink in. I clean the blade and put it away. Prince Wan Hu said, this is it. My cook has shown me how I ought to live my own life. What do you think of that? Conjure any other images or metaphors? Any application you can see to how we live in this time? Do we have anybody here that's a butcher? Okay. Well, we're going to have to find some other connection. Well, I find that, you know, both in my personal and professional life, that there's a sense of trying to force things. But because we want results, we want things done now, that it's like, well, let's just hurry up and get it done. And whether it's time for it to be done, whether it's, you know, the best way to get it done, we're in this hurry. And even in the practice of law, you know, I have clients that come in and they tell me what they want. And they usually want it yesterday. And so when I was first in practice, I'd scurry around, I'd get on the telephone, I'd call the other people, let's say they're buying a business, and well, you know, this is what the client's prepared to offer. You know, I'll draw up the contract. And I do that, and you know what would oftentimes happen? The client would come in a day or two later and say, you know, I thought about this. And I don't want it exactly quite that way. Now I want this. Well, then you have to go back and try to find a way to, you know, get what they want now and save a little face and, you know, put it together. So by the time the deal is done, you've gone through, you know, 10 drafts of the contract. People on both sides have changed their mind a gazillion times. You know, it's probably taken much longer. The expense is now higher, but the deal gets done. So what I started to learn after a number of years is that I don't jump now. First time somebody tells me what they want. Usually we talk about it first. And if I don't sense that the timing in the deal is quite right, I'll wait. And I don't always save myself extra work. I mean, there are times, again, where, you know, we have external deadlines that face us. We all have our Prince Lus that are out there that have commanded us to do things, and, you know, sooner or later we have to get it done or you know, else. But there is this sense of we have some control in how we do it. We have control, that's what I talk with students about quite often, in how we get the job done, how ethically we take a stance to what it is we have to do. And I've mentioned in my series last week, you know, I'm very sensitive to the fact that lawyers don't have a great reputation right now in the public's eye. I'm not sensitive about it in that, you know, don't say a lawyer joke around me, but I'm sensitive to the fact that we need to do something about it. And, you know, part of that, again, goes into how we do things. How we treat the other. You know, do we objectify the other? You know, if we start to objectify something, what do we do to it? If we decide what the other is, we go out into the forest with a bag of blueprints and say, tree, this is what you're going to be.
And we don't see what it really is.
Yeah, exactly. We've diminished it. we've made it less than what it really is. I mean, this bell stand was something that people said, the spirits must have inspired this thing. You know, how could you have possibly done this, a mere human person? And, you know, what, even though without his skills and gifts, he could not have accomplished what he did, it was those skills and gifts in combination with that true nature of the other that allowed him to get where he did. I thought I'd share with you an article that ran across last October that really kind of speaks to this issue as well, getting into the rhythm of things and the true nature of things. It's called Live Leisurely, and it was written by Nelvin Voss. It was appeared in the Lutheran in the October issue. And he's talking about this whole issue of busyness. He said, the sense of life speeding up is not just a vague suspicion. A recent national survey found that the amount of leisure time which the average American experiences has shrunk 37% since 1973. And so he says, well, live leisurely. You know, when I first saw this title, I thought, yeah, right, live leisurely. Isn't that easy to say, you know? But he talks about what he means by living leisurely. He said, living leisurely is not merely to be equated with having free time. To live leisurely is a quality of life, a way of looking at daily life. It is one of the important ways to connect our faith in daily living. To experience the rhythm of God's grace in all parts of one's life is the experience of true leisure. To live without being ruled by the constant tempo of efficiency is to put our complete trust in the Spirit who will guide us in God's own time. It's called it letting go and living by the grace of God. And I was struck by how similar what he's saying is to this idea of getting in touch with the other. And I, you know, Palmer doesn't limit the other to other people, and I certainly wouldn't either. It's nature. It's all of our resources. Even calling nature a resource is a utilitarian, you know, kind of a concept as far as valuing it. But again, was the moral of the story we can't cut down a tree? No. It was use something in a way that's most congruent with what its natural properties are. Don't force it to be something that it's not. Don't do violence by forcing your own will upon something. And he reminds us of the passage in Matthew and about living leisurely and traveling light. And that passage, and so my counsel is, don't worry about things, food, drink, and clothes, for you already have life in a body, and they are far more important than what to eat and wear. Look at the birds. They don't worry about what to eat. They don't sow or reap or store up food, for your heavenly Father feeds them. And you are far more valuable to him than they are. Will all your worries add a single moment to your life? Now, does this mean that, you know, we should just kind of sit back and wait for food every day to fall from the heavens? So what is it that we're supposed to take from this? You know, we said get into the rhythm of things, live leisurely, and take note by how God treats the rest of the creation. That sounds real good, but I mean, what can we carry from that into everyday life?
Well, I think this is such a materialistic society that we all are infected by that, no matter how we try not to be. The Lord certainly knew what he was talking about when he said not to build up treasure on earth, but we all do it. And that just complicates our living easily and leisurely, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, when he says he takes from that passage that we should travel light, it's like there's only so much that we really do need. And the rest is extra baggage. I had a experience with that myself on the way to Holden. You know, I told my daughter now, you know, we've got to change planes 3 times, walk through terminals. We're only going to take what we can carry. So, you know, we're each going to take a duffel and a, you know, just a small book bag, and that's it. What you can't given those we're not taking. Well, that was real good, except, you know, I folded and rolled and packed and smashed and all this sort of thing, so that, you know, I had only a couple of bags, but I nearly broke my shoulders, you know, trotting around airports with these things. And I thought, you know, I wasn't traveling lightly at all. I mean, I was just fooling myself. I thought I was traveling lightly because I got it in a couple of bags, but what I was really doing is just trying to get the same amount of stuff, but only make it not look like it was, you know, as much. And I've thought about that as I've reread this week. I thought, you know, isn't that what, at least I do, an awful lot of my life, is I try to tell myself, you know, I'm trying to live by my needs and not my wants, and I'm trying to get by with less, but then I have to look around and say, you know, am I really, you know, how much of my busyness, complexity of my life, you know, do I really bring right on myself? Just like the bags that I had to haul through the airports. I sent half the stuff back by box this last Saturday, so I'm traveling a little lighter on my home. Okay. So, the last thing that we can talk about with respect to the wood carver, I think, is results. And this is what Palmer suggests is really the fatal flaw in most of our action, is that the action is result-oriented rather than means-oriented. In other words, we don't care about the how we get there, we just care about getting there. Can you think of any examples of that? Or think of the converse example. You can think of good examples of actions where it's the getting there that's important, and the path along the way, not the destination. Well, did I hear? Oh.
Hike.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes there's a destination you have in mind, but if you don't enjoy what you're doing along the way, it's an awful arduous process. As some of you may know, I'm a sailor, and I've had some nice conversations with people that share that love over the last week and a half, and that's what I love about sailing. I mean, if you're really concerned about getting someplace, don't go by sailboat, because there's too many things that can change your plans along the way. You have to really love, you know, what happens along the way. That's kind of what the experience is all about. You know, if you're concerned about getting there, I guess get a powerboat, because, you know, your chances of getting from A to B when you want to get there are a lot better.
I think college education is the same.
Pardon?
College education is in the same category. I guess too many people are doing just with the eye on the degree at the end, but if you don't really enjoy yourself along the way and take time to explore a lot of different things, it's kind of too bad.
Yeah, we had a talk about that on the hike the other day, about people that, you know, if you narrow yourself too early on, it's again that you might miss your whole gift. I mean, the thing that is really your innate talent in life, you might pass right by because you know, you've had your eye on the prize.
I think sometimes in large organizations, you work for them, they're going to dictate kind of what the results that you want, and you have a tendency to lose your own inner freedom in trying to attain those results, or lose yourself in trying to get those results instead of really trying to draw the results you want out of that. Or put some of yourself in there. It's pretty easy to get lost.
Do you have any ideas on what we can do about that when we find ourselves kind of stuck?
I think anybody can inject change, even bigger organizations. But, you know, at some point in time, if they're putting too much, you can definitely make a move to go to something else. Or, you know, do what you can within that. Or whatever charge they give you to do to maintain it, you know, and get into doing it the way that you want. want to see it done. We get really caught up in what does the customer want, and providing what the customer wants, and sometimes the customer's not totally intelligent, not to work, but doesn't know the biggest picture, to know what's the best for them, they just think they know what they
That's what I find with clients sometimes. They think they know what they want, but maybe they've only thought about the immediate what they want, and not the long range what they want, or the possibilities of what, you know, what might be out there. And I think to achieve those kind of possibilities requires that you take risks. And in the system that you're describing, you know, risks mean that you may not get results. And that somebody else who's gotten results, even though they may be sort of on a little bitty scale, they might get the reward, whereas a plan that's on a grander scale that may have far more long-range benefits for the company, for society, you know, for whomever the external forces are, we completely lose that opportunity because we're afraid to take that chance. We talked a little bit about failure yesterday, and somebody said, oh, I don't like that word because, you know, that's not, just because you don't give somebody what they expect, you know, that isn't a failure. You know, let's talk about failure a little bit. How would you define failure? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Something we avoid at all costs? Something that might be useful?
I don't know, if I had succeeded as often as I failed, I think I'd be a lot better off than I am now, maybe. But I mean, it's just, you got to accept it. You're not going to succeed every time. You learn through failure or through mistakes or whatever. It's just it's a way to grow, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, science is the one model, and there probably are others, that accepts failure as an everyday part of its endeavor. I mean, that's what experimentation is all about. And an experiment might fail as far as a method of proving a certain hypothesis, but something else might be learned that's far more beneficial. But is that the model that we teach in school? No. I mean, and, you know, that I think is a real dilemma. Another seed in, you know, why are we doing more and enjoying it less, is that we're programming kids from early on. This is the path to success. Listen to what your teacher says and spit that back at the time that you're examined on it. You know, original thought is not rewarded. And I mean, I'm starting to see changes in that in educational systems, but, you know, not in a broad scale way, because why? Well, when you get out into the economic, productive, consumptive world, again, that's the pattern in our Western culture that we're enforcing. And I think, so we don't end on that kind of a down note, I'd like to finish by, you know, tossing out a few ways in which I see that there are some patterns developing, that this whole idea of getting in synchrony with, you know, yourself and the world and finding the congruence with the other in an activity is being found not only to be more satisfying and spiritual for the people who are involved in the process, but surprise is also being found to be more beneficial in that productive sense. And maybe there is more congruity. Since most of you were here yesterday, I'm not going to read again the article from the magazine that I brought in. But what I found is that a corporation, a small company, not IBM, not Xerox, although they're doing these things too, they're looking to the human nature of the employee, and they're saying employees have families. Employees have children to take care of, they have parents that they're concerned about, they may have elderly relatives with them, They're concerned for the education of their children. They're concerned for the welfare. They sometimes have emergencies that come up. And so this company has created a daycare center for dependent adults, summer camps, scholarships, you know, leave time for families to take care of matters at home. And what they found is that they have far less absenteeism. Their productivity has never been better. There's never been greater loyalty to the company. And they couldn't be happier, you know, from a profit model. And I think that that's what I found most inspirational about this book. And it's been helpful to me in trying to sort through this frenzy of my life and feeling like that hummingbird, is that when you act in a faithful way, that sort of faithful right action that he talks about that respects the true essence of the other, the participant in what you're doing, that ironically you get results. Just like a wood carver with a tree in a way that wasn't violent to the tree, didn't force the action upon them.
There's a Zen saying that the best way to control your sheep is to give them a large and spacious meadow. Somehow it seems a little bit appropriate to that, yeah, too.
Exactly. So if we'd like to sit and chat about this, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. This is one of the reasons that I chose to talk about this at Holden, because there's always good things to be learned from one another. Anybody have anything happen that bears this out, either in a positive or negative way? Anything innovative going on in your churches or jobs or communities? Or
in my in-laws' church, just a little small church in Dillon, Montana, the minister has started a blood pressure thing, and he has two registered nurses that are not actively working, and they'll take blood pressures every Sunday. And people go to them.
Mm-hmm. It's a way of reaching out and realizing that there's more to church than just coming there on Sunday. Yeah. Some needs. Well, if anyone is interested in looking at this book at all, I think I saw one copy left this morning at the book center, and if that's gone and you'd like to order it, I recommend it as good reading. I'd be happy to give you the publisher, and also you can order it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.